Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Now I have a great interview with Chris Haskett, who actually is the guitarist from the Henry Rollins Band and also played with David Bowie. He explains how he met Henry and what drew him to guitar.
We met when we were teenagers. There were, you know, there were like 20 kids that were visibly into like punk rock. Yeah, so I've known him since I was like 15 or 16, but we went to different schools. My first band was a band called The Enzymes, which is like this amalgam of like The Damned, Sun Ra, Captain Beefheart, and God knows what, you know, just having fun. And Henry was in a band called State of Alert, and Ian was at that point doing Teen Idols. So this is all when we were like teenagers, long before Henry joined Black Flag. What got me into guitar? Well, I was scared of girls, and I needed, you know, and I was kind of class clown nerd type, and just, you know, found something else that was kind of cool that could just be mine, you know. And I have an older brother who had an SG with a side pull trem. I was lucky because he was really into some good music. So when I was a little kid, you know, when I was like 7, I inherited like his copy of Disraeli Gears and his copy of Blind Faith and his copy of Electric Ladyland. Kind of became very enamored of Keith Richards. I was like, he was like my hero, which I think worried the school a little bit. But for me, it was like, it was just an alternative. It was just like a way of finding an identity that, and finding something that was cool. And the music really spoke to me. It just kind of gripped me the way I think, you know, music does with little kids. And it's kind of, it was just my thing. And I stuck with it. I was never very diligent. I'm still not very diligent. And I wasn't one of those guys who just sits in the room and practices scales all day. I did everything the hard way. But yes, like I said, just more of a misfit, and misfits tend to find each other. So I ended up in a band with, you know, misfits from one of the local Catholic schools. It was like a mix of like The Damned and the Orchestra. Cause, I mean, it's interesting because when punk rock was first getting going, there was less punk rock coming down to Washington than there was free jazz. So, you know, as teenagers that we were watching, we would go to like a place in town called DC Space, and we would go see the orchestra, or we'd go see the World Saxophone Quartet, or we'd go see Anthony Braxton, you know. And then we go see Stiff Little Fingers or whoever. Obviously, the music was unrelated, but the freedom and to a certain degree, the amount of rebellion in these things kind of a common theme. You know, as a teenager, you recognize it. You're like, well, they're just doing what they want. I joined my very first band at a Fred Frith gig. So, yeah, because Fred Frith came down, and like everybody, nobody knew who Fred Frith was except that he'd been on Eno Records, and Brian Eno Records were like gold. All the like nerds came out from their holes to go see somebody who'd played on an Eno record. It's like a convention. It's like, wow, my people are here. I think it must be like, you know, like being like a gay teenager in a small town and discovering gay bars. It's like, oh my God, there's a whole world of me out here. You know, music, especially back then, because we're talking like 1977, 78. It was a different time. I mean, that's why it took me until my 30s to actually appreciate Aerosmith and Led Zeppelin. But in terms of the early stuff, I mean, yeah, I started out, even though I was into punk rock, my guitar heroes were Keith Richards and Johnny Winter.
Yeah, Chris, you're absolutely right. Back in the 70s, it was a whole different vibe. You had a sense of belonging, especially when you were a musician and an outcast as being a musician. Now he tells me how he got into the Henry Rollins Band.
The Enzymes allegedly got paid when we played some of these like terrible squats in D.C., but that wasn't really, you know, we were just teenagers, we were just high school kids. When I went to college, I did 2 years in the States, and then I moved to England, and I moved to Leeds. Like where Who Live of Leeds is recorded. And while I was there, I ended up in a surf trash rock band. So it was sort of like somewhere between like Jonathan Richman and The Replacements. It was really fun, yeah. And we weren't terribly good, but people liked it. And we ended up signing with the Belgian label and playing around England a lot. So we did a lot of gigs with Billy Bragg back in the early days. That was my first chance of touring Europe. It was, you know, in the back of a van. The band was called Surfing Dave and the Absent Legends. While I was actually, that band was on a hiatus, that Henry and I actually made the first record together. His Black Flag had just broken up, and he was like, hey, you know, and we'd been corresponding, and we were still in touch and swapping tapes, and, you know, I happened to be in D.C., and he happened to be there, and, you know, I think Gin Cole called him up and said, you know, Black Flag's breaking up. And basically, it was within days, he was like, okay, let's do something. You got a bunch of riffs. I can write some lyrics. Go find some musicians and book a studio. So I did, you know, but while I was kind of in Surfing Dave, and then Surfing Dave kind of broke up anyway. Bronze was the first full-time band. Still living in England at that point, but I happened to be in America visiting my folks, and Henry happened to be back in D.C. And then that became the tail that wagged the dog. I mean, you know, so because the other band really wasn't, my Surfing Dave wasn't going anywhere at that point, and, you know, this was something to do, and it was cool. It was different, you know. that incarnation of Rollins Band lasted 10 years. So we're like basically 87 or 88 to 97. 97, November something, 97. Our last gig was in Osaka. I remember this because I was like, it was clear that everybody was like pretty burned out. And, you know, it was one of those Spinal Tap moments where I remember sitting at dinner, you know, and I didn't realize it at the time, you know, it's, but if you've seen in Spinal Tap, it's like, you know, where he says, you know, so are we going to play Stonehenge tonight? And I said, you know, it was like that. I said, so maybe we should talk about next year. And everybody just, you know, glared at me. But that's so often the way when you're in a band. I mean, you know, being in a band, it's like being in an arranged polygamous marriage. Yeah, so that was 10 years. And then after that, I kind of spun my wheels a little bit. I'm not a good self-starter. So I've always got like 80% of the energy to get a project off the ground, or 80% of the material I need. I think I'm somebody who needs a collaborator. I always run out of steam before I can take things fully to fruition, which is why I ended up making records basically just on my own. Usually my kind of current MO, which started then, which is guitar, bass, drums, and drums, which I got from Sonny Chirac. And I just love the sound of two percussion voices. You know, sometimes it can be a drummer and a percussionist, or sometimes it's two drummers. And I was doing stuff around New York back then, playing like, you know, the Knit and places like that. But again, the audience for that kind of music kind of dissipated. People got older and other stuff came along. So it just gets harder and harder to get gigs. Yeah, people get their entertainment different ways now. And like the people that initially would come out to go to the Knitting Factory or go to Tonic or even go to CBGBs, you know, they've got mortgages and kids. And like, you know, like you and me, they've moved out of the city. They don't go out that much, because I was living in Europe for the last 10 years. And even there, it's hard to get gigs. It was hard to find people to play with.
Yeah, the new generation, they do a whole different line of entertainment. When I was a teenager, we used to run out and try to sneak into all the shows and the concerts to check out musicians. That no longer exists. Now he explains how he got hooked up with David Bowie.
Reeves Gabrels and I were hanging out a lot. We were both in New York and just kind of, you know, we're very like-minded in a lot of things, and we're very cordial. And he was working with David on songwriting at that point. You know, I just started hanging out. They were recording at Chungking, which was around the corner from where I used to live. So I used to kind of go around and have coffee and hang out with Reeves, and very gradually got to know David. And you're just kind of, as they say, you know, if you hang out in a barbershop, eventually you get a haircut. I think Reeves very kindly engineered it for me to play on a song that he could have done both parts on, but he's like, no, I need a second guitar player. Let's get Haskett to do it. I think I knew slightly more about running Logic and doing MIDI than he did. He was like, we need somebody for the band who can do a little bit, who can do all these things, to play a little bit of guitar, do a little bit of MIDI. And I was like, okay. And so I got hired. I played on one song on one record. I got hired for a tour, which subsequently got canceled. No, it's like, oh, you played with David Bowie. And I'm like, well, kind of. I mean, yes. I mean, my favorite memory of David actually is he, you know, he taught me a lot about 20th century British painting, and he showed me how to use eBay. Right. My David Bowie story is that around watching C-SPAN for a summer, you know, well, you know, when there was nothing else to do in the studio. But I always say to people, you know, there was like, you know, so you played with David Bowie. I'm like, have you ever heard of Stacey Hayden? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, Stacey Hayden did most of the Station to Station tour when Earl Slick wasn't there. He played with David Bowie. I didn't. But I feel very privileged. I've been able to like hang out and, you know, learn how to use eBay. I was just more kind of in the studio. That was Mark Plotty's record, you know. So I was just more there originally as Reeves' friend. What I did do, which was really nice, was after the tour fell through, David threw me some work, which was, you know, he was one of the first people that had really understood the internet as a, you know, as a musician. He had one of the most together largest websites, you know, of a lot of the artists of that time. It's called BowieNet. And at that point, this is way back when everybody was still using like dial-up modems, right? He was working with Thomas Dolby, approached him with the company that he was working with. I can't remember what they were called, but it was about making soundifying websites, so providing sound for websites, because this is before there was Flash and everything, and you could embed sound. So it was this idea of there would be a sound bank that would play remotely via HTML on whatever website you want. So anyway, so David contacted me and said, look, I want you to, if you're interested, why don't you work with Thomas Dolby on, I want you to write the score for BowieNet. And I was like, wow, okay, cool. I mean, the software wasn't very good. It didn't do what they said it did. So it was actually quite difficult. But I'm very proud of that. It was kind of cool because I had to make an interactive score that responded to where the mouse went on the web page. So it had to be a little bit like Terry Riley's In C, you know, that piece? With the Riley piece, no matter which musician is playing which bar on which instrument, it all has to work, which is why, of course, it's literally in C. I had to make it so that, everything worked, and I didn't do it in C, but I mean, everything had to work rhythmically and it had to work harmonically. And that was, it was really cool. It was really difficult because, like I said, the software wasn't good. But what was nice was, I, you know, it occurred to me when I was done, I was like, you know, well, David Bowie asked me to write music. It's a bit like Bruce Lee asking you to be his bodyguard. He was lovely. You know, he was really nice. Yeah, that was, it was a special moment, but I mean, but I'm always wary when I was like, keep the, oh my God, you played with David Bowie in perspective. That said, at the gig with Adrian Belew and Jerry Leonard, I actually took it so that I could play with Carmine Rojas, the bass player. I was like, because he's another one, like, oh my God, that's Carmine Rojas. I'm going to get on stage with him, you know. And it was nice, even without David, to be able to actually go up and get on stage with those people and play like Ziggy Stardust in 5 years and stuff like that. The first time I ever met David was actually at a festival. In fact, that's the first time I ever met Reeves. And as we were leaving, I was like, oh my God, I see him with this Bowie up on the side of the stage. And he was on the side of the stage, and I ran up while I think Chemical Brothers were playing, and I said, hey, look, you know, I just wanted to bother you. You probably won't understand this. I just wanted to say thank you to you for everything you've given me. And he looked at me, he was very earnest, he went, of course I understand. And I was like, who did you ever have to say thank you to? And he said, I knew John Lennon. Yeah, and what to me it was like really cool. So it's again like the McLaughlin thing, where John McLaughlin took some time to just be collegial with a stranger and have a cool moment. It was really nice for me to think, wow, you know, David, you know, the way I just felt kind of to David, David felt that way to somebody else, which is just, again, it's nice when you feel like there's a kind of continuity, like we're all part of a chain, giving that stuff on, passing that stuff on to other people, you know.
That is such a great thing to do, to go up to one of your heroes or people that you have been influenced by and thank them. So many people don't even think about that. Now he explains his whole rundown with gear, guitars, amps, PRS, and the whole deal.
The SG I still have that I used for a long time with Rollins. That's kind of a workhorse, as a lot of, you know, good SGs are. You know what it's like. There's too many guitars to go through. Mostly nowadays, since 1990, my go-to guitars have been PRS CE24s, standard PRS bolt-ons, which are slightly modified to actually have less. Like, you know, the original PRSs, they had the rotary switch and, you know, and a tone control. And I said, that's cool. Take the tone control out. Replace the rotary switch with a Gibson three-way toggle. Replace the tone control with a single coil to humbucking switch, and then I'm done. Three CE24s that are like that. So it's just volume control only, single coil and humbucking and a pickup selector. And also, I had a PRS, two P90s, like a slab mahogany two P90s. But I've got a made in Korea or made in Vietnam or made in Indonesia. Hamer, it's a Les Paul Junior. It's a double cutaway slab mahogany with still P90 in it. And it's amazing. It's just, you know, again, you sometimes with cheap guitar, you find one of the good ones. And that's another one of, like, throw it in the back of the car and then find out what the gig is. It'll do whatever you need it to do. You know what I mean? Recently, I went to PRS with a, just because I've known Paul for a very long time, and he kind of indulges my weirder idiosyncrasies. I sent them an idea that I had for a very long time for a 9-string. When I was in Rollins Band, I used a lot of like 12-string voicings, just using a whammy pedal. I really loved the sound of a 12-string coursing, but I didn't want to have a double neck, and I didn't want to have to play a 12-string all the time. So what I was doing was using my Strat 12 with only the low strings coursed and the high strings single. But the string spacing on that makes it very hard to play. So I went to Paul and just went, look, you know, can we make a 9-string, which is, you know, with only the low strings coursed and the high strings single, but spaced correctly? And he was like, yeah. So they converted an existing 12-string, recut the nut, recut the headstock. And it's beautiful. It's amazing. I'll send you a picture of it. And it's really good. I mean, I want to send a picture of it to John McLaughlin. Just like, send one to Jimmy Page. It's like, here, spare your shoulders. Try this instead. Well, I call it the bring it on home guitar. Because, again, you can play. You can get that slightly chorused effect of the chorused double low strings. Like, you know, you can play the intro to Birds of Fire, right? But the single strings make it so you can still actually bend and solo easily. So for me, it's kind of a best of both worlds. And on top of which, you know, it's nice we've got something that nobody else has done yet. I was kind of amazed that nobody had made a guitar this way. They've done it the other way. So like Vox used to make a Phantom 13 or something like that, where again, the high strings were doubled. Now, BC Rich made one that had doubled strings. Again, only the high strings and the D string were doubled. It's a BC Rich Bitch 10, I think it was called. But it was interesting to me, nobody had done it the other way. Because, you know, guitar players are tinkerers, right? We just can't help messing with stuff. So I figured somebody must have done this already, and that would be one that I could just buy on my gig. So now I usually take one of the CE24s, or maybe the Hamer, but usually a CE24, because I liked having the tremolo, and one of the 9-strings. I usually just take 2 guitars to a gig. The Hamer is just a regular 6-string Les Paul Junior with a P90. And the only thing I changed in that is I put in heavier gauge cloth wire and a better capacitor and better pots. It made it, you know, 1% difference, but it's psychological. But it's important to how you feel about what you're doing. That helps you make the music you're making, you know. With Rollins, I was, you know, using the dual rectifiers. It was like, I think I must have been one of the early adopters for the PRS and dual rectifier combinations. And so with Rollins Band, it was all stock dual rectifiers with EL34s set on the silicone diode rectifier circuit. And I still have a tremo verb, you know, which is the open back 212 version. But even that's overkill for most of the stuff I'm doing nowadays. So nowadays for gigs, I'm actually using a TA-30, which is also a Mesa Boogie, and it's the transatlantic. It's their version of a hybrid Vox. I really love it. It's got a lot more sparkle and a lot more for the way I'm playing now, because, you know, your amp, it's kind of like food and wine. Your amp has to really match the tone, you know, the tones you're trying to get. As I get older, I use a lot less gain. I'm using a lot less distortion because I find that I'm just more interested in the subtleties of tone and the more sublime aspects of the guitar voice. So I love the TA-30. My only problem is that every once in a while, one of the channels will just stop working. And I think it has to do with the foot switch. But when it's working properly, it sounds amazing. And the nice thing, it has a switchable wattage. So I very rarely actually have it above 15 watts on stage. It's tube, and most of the stages I'm playing are club stages. So, and I've actually got a couple of others that I don't use for gigs, but I use for recording. I just moved from Europe to Australia, and when I was living in the Netherlands, I found these amazing old German tube amps. I picked up a 1959 Schaller, which again, it sounds like an AC30. It's beautiful. It's got this amazing shimmer to it. And I had, it's 3 channels. It's like in a guitar channel, bass channel, and accordion, because it's from like 1959. I had it modded so that the preamp channel from the bass channel maxes a pre-gain for the guitar channel. And it has this lovely kind of glass-like high-end shimmer. Not shrieky, but it's just beautiful. That was lucky. And then I also found like a 1960 Dynacord 18 watt, which I also had modded. So I'm into this kind of German tube amp fetish by accident. And I use those for recording. Nowadays also, I'm much more open to just whatever presents itself a little bit. That said, I'm more like, I'm a musician. I'm going to see what does the room sound like today? What does my amp sound like today? What does the guitar sound like today? Rather than being, you know, when I was younger, it was like, oh my God, I have to have my tone. It has to be exactly the same every day. I've got to go up on stage and know exactly what I'm getting. So I'm much more open to being a little more open to the situation and also responding to it musically. So, you know, you you can go back, like you're working on a track, you go back to it, and so all of a sudden you can't remember how you structured it initially, and you're kind of lost. You're like, okay, well, how do I work with this? Rather than, you know, when I was younger, I would like panic and go, oh my God, I've lost the thread. And I'm like, okay, this is what the weather is today. Let's deal with it. Yeah, sometimes I'll take a guitar that I think won't work in order just to make myself make the effort. It's like for a while when I was with Rollins, it sounds kind of perverse, but if I had a solo, I would almost always make the first note something that just didn't work. Then you've got to sell it. You know, it's kind of like, okay, make it, here you are, you know, now you're a musician, make music, you know. You know, I remember Jerry Garcia has a really good quote about this. He said soloing is like untying a knot. And some days you untie it and some days you just don't. When I'm soloing, if I'm not improvising, I feel like I'm cheating.
You know, I have to completely agree with Chris. You know, when I'm in the studio or play live, I really like to improvise. I don't really like to work out solos ahead of time unless it's part of a melody. So now Chris tells me about all his new projects and his new albums he's working on.
I mean, everything takes so long in the pipeline that, you know, whenever I put out a new record, it's already 2 years old. So I just put out Insufficient Necessities, which is just a 4-song EP with my Dutch band, a fantastic bass player from one of the go-go bands, a guy called Michael Baker, who plays in Rare Essence from DC, who played bass on one track. But I've got the four-song EP that just came out, and I've got another album mostly from the same sessions, which I'm finishing, and it's almost all covers. There's a Sun Ra track, two Grateful Dead tracks, one of which is done in like 1950s bebop style. There's a Ronnie Montrose instrumental, Blood Alley 157. I wish I'd discovered Ronnie Montrose earlier. I mean, just what a guitar player. There's a Led Zeppelin, believe it or not. I found an unreleased jam outtake from I think, Houses of the Holy Sessions. So I kind of jigged that. I'm not sure how the publishing is going to work on that, but there's a Monk tune. There's a Sonny Rollins tune. Average White Band. It's eclectic. It's all covers. I might cover one of my own tunes. You know, maybe I can have that out by like next summer, North American summer next year. And then after that, I have got to find new people here, you know, got to find a new band. Australia, fortunately, has a very, very large pool of very high quality musicians. So it's more a question of just going and finding them and convincing them to play my weird music for no money. Melbourne's still really strong. Melbourne's got like lots of music venues and a really strong live music scene. Sydney has a lot of bands, but the number of places for them to play is getting smaller and smaller and further and further out of the center. I guess one of the luxuries of not being popular is it doesn't really matter where I play because I mostly just see the floor anyway, right? What's your demographic? It's linoleum. There's sometimes it's carpeted. And also, I think getting paid is gone by the wayside. I think, you know, the days where you could just be a working musician, like in New York, and make rent. Long tradition. There's a lot of good bands down here. I remember when we used to come down here with Rollins Band, it was always like, there's a standard. You really had to bring your A game when you came to Australia. So, yeah, it's slow going. The first thing is, you know, get the kids comfortable and put them in school and then figure out where I can, you know, go to IKEA and get some bookcases, you know. And the guitars should come first, but they're going to come last. I brought one little amp. I found a 1950s portable Philips turntable, and it had a little, you know, 8-watt tube amp in it. So I ripped the guts out of it, had it modded, had a guitar input put on it. So I use it. And it sounds sort of like a Fender Champ. That's the amp I have up at the house at the moment, my little, you know, yellow Tortex Philips turntable amp. It looks like a little Jetsons vacuum cleaner. It's totally cool. I mean, of course, you know, I fell in love with the Tortex before I knew what was in it. But fortunately, there was a little amp. So that's the only amp I have at the house at the moment. Do anything I want to add? No, not really. I mean, just everybody should try and be kind to each other, and we should fix the climate. I'm easy to contact. I mean, if anybody wants to drop me a line, it's been lovely chatting. It's always good to talk to other musicians.
I had a great time speaking with Chris. I always am so interested in what other guitar players do and what they're influenced by and what their rig's all about. And I actually like this album that he did called No Part of the Solution. It's a rock electronica. So I'm going to start it out with Roy Kill Was Here.
This is guitarist Chris Haskett, and you're listening to Guitar Tracks, WFIT, home of the Guitar Master Series.
That was a block of Chris Haskett from the Henry Rollins Band. That's Dodgem from his new album, Insufficient Necessities. And also from the same album was Ivy City before that.